Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Almost 20 years ago, political analyst Rui Teixeira co-authored the boldly titled book, The Emerging Democratic Majority. In it, he and John Judis foretold of the end of the Republican hegemony. They explored how political realignments work in American history and concluded that other major realignments were underway. Specifically, quote, it took from 1968 to 1980 for the New Deal majority to collapse and for a new conservative Republican majority to be born, they wrote. They went on. They said, and it is taking from 1992 until sometime this decade, that was in the early 2000s, for the conservative Republican majority to disintegrate and for a new Democratic majority to emerge. At the ballot box, though, that has not happened. And today, we're going to talk with Rui Teixeira about why he thinks Democrats have failed to build a cohesive political majority and what he thinks his party should do about it. So let's start with what happened last week in the state of Virginia. Democrats could believe that Virginia was becoming reliably blue. President Joe Biden won there by 10 points exactly a year ago. But last week, Republican Glenn Youngkin won the Virginia governor's race, becoming the first Republican to win statewide office in a dozen years. So we spoke with several Virginia voters who cast their ballots for Biden in 2020 and for Youngkin in 2021. Mark Farley is an independent. He works in sales, and in the last four presidential elections, he voted for Obama, then Romney, then Trump, then Biden. He also has misgivings about the GOP under the sway of Trumpism, especially after the mob attack on Congress.
I was not happy with January the 6th, and I feel that if Trump would have stood up and it would have not happened, that really lost a lot of credibility with me.
But when it came time to cast his ballot in the gubernatorial race last week, Farley was motivated by issues much closer to home.
Have you been to the grocery store recently? Oh my goodness. The inflation is out of this world and wages aren't going up. So anywhere, myself as well as, my brothers and sisters and neighbors can save to put more on the table at the end of the day for their family is big with me.
That's why Glenn Youngkin's proposal to eliminate Virginia's grocery tax ultimately helped swing Farley's vote. Christopher Dombeck describes himself as fiscally conservative and socially liberal. He has voted for Republicans and Democrats. This year, the issue that motivated him...
Schools are everything. For your property tax, that's 75-80% of your money. And these schools were closed for over a year. People had to quit their jobs, some people quit their jobs because they have kids that they're trying to have in elementary school on Zoom all day. And it became difficult for a lot of people.
Dombeck also says he is concerned by what's taught in Virginia schools when they're in sessions. But it's not what you think. He was not distracted by the controversy over critical race theory. In fact, Dombeck thinks issues of race should be taught in schools. But what he focused on is what he sees as a disturbing reduction in Virginia's overall academic standards, such as the Virginia Mathematics Pathways Initiative, which proposed ending tracking for kids struggling with or accelerated in mathematics. Now, the state cited the National Council of Supervisors of Mathematics with, quote, tracking too often leads to segregation and disproportionately impacts minority and low socioeconomic students.
The number one goal out of the state for education was to create equity in math. And one of its largest things said 72% of college majors don't require calculus. And you're thinking, we live in this area, so people... their kids can take the difficult classes and have a chance to go to a really good school. And on a state level, you want to remove the advanced classes. So you have all ethnicities basically almost scoring a passing rate on math. And it caused a lot of controversy here. And this is not with the MAGA crowd. This is with people who are not upper middle class, but college graduates who want their kids to go to college. They chose to live and have a long commute in this area specifically for that reason. And you're taking away the kids' future.
There was one more factor for both these voters: how they perceive the tone of Democratic candidate Terry McAuliffe's campaign.
It's like there was no making room. There was no accommodation to try to accept people in the Democratic Party. It does not felt like the Democrats actually made an attempt to get us.
And Mark Farley says even though he was appalled by the January 6th insurrection, as you heard him say earlier, and the role that Donald Trump played in that, he didn't like how ads for McAuliffe continually tried to tie Youngkin together with Trump.
On education, whose lead would Glenn Youngkin follow?
President Trump represents so much of why I'm running.
That's right. Glenn Youngkin would bring Donald Trump and Betsy DeVos's education policies to Virginia. Youngkin's...
It was almost childish, very unprofessional. And I know you're going to get that in politics, but that was the only messages I heard, like, were just, oh, you know, we don't need another Trump. Okay, I agree with, you know, that, but what are you going to do? What are you going to work on? What are you going to, you know, make better? How, at the end of the day, when I go home to my family, am I going to be in a better situation with you as governor?
A window into why two potentially Democratic voters in Virginia decided to cast their ballot for a Republican governor instead. Well, Rui Teixeira is with us now. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, co-editor of the Liberal Patriot newsletter. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, in 2002, he co-authored The Emerging Democratic Majority, and his most recent book is The Optimistic Left. Rui Teixeira, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be here.
Jack Beattie is also with us. He's On Point's news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Rui.
So,
hey, Jack.
So, Rui, what do you hear in Mark and Christopher's thinking there, those two Virginia voters?
Well, they did touch on a number of things that I think were obviously going to be a problem for the Democrats no matter what. You know, obviously, and we have had a surge of inflation as the economy has been recovering and you have supply problems. People are going to be somewhat sensitive to that. You always were going to have a sense in which the Democrats are going to be susceptible to a thermostatic reaction from being the party in power. And this is an off-year election in which people might move at least somewhat against the incumbent party. So I think those things were in play. But I think what's really interesting about what they were saying is this sense I think a lot of these voters have, or these voters exemplify it, that the Democrats are sort of out over their skis. They're not really listening to voters like them. They're simply saying Trump, 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 as if that was sort of a magical mantra that would convince everyone to vote for the Democrats forever. And of course, you know, in the end, parties have to produce and parties have to listen to the constituencies that brought them to office. And I think that really came out on the issue of particularly education in this race, as, you know, pretty much everybody realizes at this point. There are concerns that these voters have about what's happening to the quality of education in the places they live, on top of all the closures that happened with COVID and the decline in academic achievement that's documented by the tests. People are wondering, why are we, you know, sort of going on and on and on about stuff about getting rid of tracking and, you know, sort of equity, anti-racist education above all, and a sense that Democrats don't seem to be concerned about these issues, and that if they are, or if they even mention them, it's to denounce them as essentially meaningless and ginned up by Fox News and their racist dog whistles. I mean, yeah. I don't know how many times McAuliffe used that phrase. And they're imaginary. I don't think you can win elections by telling voters their concerns are imaginary. And I think Democrats, McAuliffe really kind of thought he could, that there really was no response he needed to give to these concerns mm-hmm. about schools other than to say they're racist. And there's no mantra he needed to say other than Trump, 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 Trump. And I think that was found wanting by the electorate in Virginia.
So let me You know, the we could talk about Virginia all day long because there are some things very particular to the race there that are particular to Virginia. But of course, the reason why I was very pleased that you could join us today is because of your, you know, two decade long continual analysis of where the Democratic Party was heading. You know, and 20 years ago, in fact, one of the first shows that I produced as an on-point producer was you when the Emerging Democratic Majority book came out. And you talked back then about this realignment that you and John Judas said was going on. So today, what would you tell the Rui Teixeira from 20 years ago about would that alignment actually come to pass?
Well, I want to make clear that, you know, our analysis, even in 2002, is not the Democrats were going to dominate forever and they'd win every election, rather that the sort of tectonic plates of American politics were shifting in a way that should advantage the Democrats given demographic, economic, and ideological changes. And I think roughly, in many ways, that turned out to be true, right? You can say that we do, in fact, now have a Democratic majority. It's just inefficiently distributed, right? The Democrats have, in fact, gained strength in a lot of metropolitan areas and a lot of states. They've certainly gained from a realignment of the professional class. The non-white share of the electorate has certainly grown and still mostly votes Democratic. And that's resulted in a situation where they won the popular vote in the presidential election 7 out of 8 times. The problem is that in terms of actual political power, that strength is inefficiently distributed. It's even inefficiently distributed in the Electoral College, but even worse, it's inefficiently distributed in terms of the Senate and the House and state legislatures. So the Democrats, as they have gained with these constituencies, in a geographical sense, these constituencies are concentrated in a way that minimizes their overall effect on political power.
Jack,
so that is something I think we should have paid more attention to when we wrote the book, and we did not. The second thing that I want to mention here, and I think is very important, is we specifically said in the book that our analysis is predicated on the idea the Democrats were able to retain a certain level of working class, particularly white working class support, and that if they do, these other changes should really benefit them. However, that did not turn out to be the case, which sort of goes with this geographical polarization thing. They lost tremendous support among the white working class over time as the Democrats were increasingly
I got to take it back from you here, Rui, for just a second, because we have 10 seconds before the break. But that sort of latter half of what the Democratic Party hasn't done in the past 20 years is what we're going to pick up on when we come back. And Jack, I'll start with you when we get back from the break. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Rui Teixeira. He's a longtime political analyst, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and co-editor of the newsletter The Liberal Patriot. He's been looking at the Democratic Party for several decades now, and we're asking him what he sees in the party's future going forward, especially after the election of a Republican governor in the state of Virginia. And Jack Beattie is also with us as well. He's On Point's news analyst. And Jack, I'm sorry I couldn't get to you before the break there, but go ahead and give us your first swing here about what you think about what Virginia revealed and sort of what you heard Rui Teixeira share before the break.
Well, a striking feature of the Virginia results were the overwhelming margins that Glenn Youngkin got in rural areas. He carried 15 counties by more than 80% of the vote. And that rural, mostly white vote for Republican candidates is, of course, emblematic of the of what's happened nationally. And why has that happened? And why has that hurt the Democrats? Well, FDR said that the point of the Democratic Party was to protect people against what he called the hazards and vicissitudes of life, of which the capitalist revolution is one of the chief, the vortex of creative destruction that makes for change under capitalism. The Democrats, at their best, stood for, no, we're going to protect you and insofar as we can, shore you up against the gales of creative destruction. Under Bill Clinton, the Democrats plunged rural America into those gales of destruction. The two trade deals, NAFTA and the normalization with China, both of which passed with overwhelming Republican votes and overwhelming negative Democratic votes, those introduced instabilities in rural America that the Democrats are still paying for. There's a map of research that shows areas that were affected by the China shock, the imports from China driving American firms and industries out of business. And that map, you can see it in Virginia, big part of the red, whole swaths of the state lost in furniture, lost in plastics, mm-hmm. lost in toys, et cetera, et cetera. And that map goes all across the Midwest and border. And the Democrats did that. You know, in India last year, Hillary Clinton in an interview said, you know, we carried the prosperous parts of the country. It's true. Mm. But since when is that a Democratic boast? And this, it isn't that people woke up every day and say, those damn Democrats, they did me out of my job and I'm going to. No, it's that it made them feel hopeless. It made them feel the system wasn't about them, and it made them vulnerable to a demagogue. And what did Donald Trump run on? Trade.
Yeah. So, Rui Teixeira, I think Jack helps us sort of reframe here a little bit. And I really want to focus on with both of you, the analysis of when we say Democrats, we're not talking about everyone who's ever voted democratically. What we're really talking about here is party leadership, the party elite, the influential policy and political players that sort of help shape what the party's core is, its messaging, etc. So, you know, given all that Jack said, what are those people missing about potential voters that they can't reach for or haven't reached for some reason?
Right. Well, I think, you know, what Jack said is very on point, that trying to understand why Democrats have lost so much support in working class areas of the country, particularly white, small town and rural America, but in a lot of suburban areas as well. There is a sense among these voters that elites have pretty much forgotten about them, including in the Democratic Party. And I don't think you can understand the rise of Trumpism without taking that sense into account. And it's very important, though, in this context, and it connects to some of the debates that are going on today, to overlay on that the cultural shifts of the Democratic Party significantly to the left and a whole variety of issues around race, gender, trans issues, a variety of other things, which put them kind of at odds with a lot of these voters. So they not only feel that national Democrats don't really care about them in a broad sense, but are urging a culture on them that they feel quite uncomfortable with. And you put the two things together and it helps explain why you have this tremendous move of these kinds of working class, white working class voters away from the Democratic Party. And very importantly, in 2020, we also see non-white working class voters starting to bail out from the Democratic Party, particularly Hispanics, who are tied to the Democratic Party by their belief Democrats are by and large friendly to immigrants and certainly against discrimination, but also are primarily about helping working class people with health, healthcare, education, jobs, community development, and so on. I mean, they think Democrats were the people on their side, and they feel a lot of these voters are starting to feel like Democrats, the priorities for Democrats are not to help them with those things. The priorities of Democrats seem to be other places. And that in turn connects to this emerging hegemony in the Democratic Party by college educated liberal, particularly white college educated liberals, where, you know, young people who are a sort of a relatively small percentage of the population, but are tremendously dominant in Democratic circles, tremendously dominant in nonprofits, foundations, advocacy groups, staffing the Democratic Party. They have a cultural mindset that puts them at odds with a lot of the people in this country. And their tendency, and again, this is very important, is to look at those people who aren't buying into this cultural change and are, you know, sort of significantly attracted to Trump, perhaps. They're all racist, right? I mean, that is, you can't overestimate the significance of looking down on people and denouncing them as a bunch of racists. I mean, it's just going to alienate them and make them incredibly unpersuadable toward your point of view, even if they agree with it in some way.
You know, I don't want us to limit the strength of today's analysis. I don't want a public radio decorum to be the limiting factor here. I want the gloves to come off, because I do think that the Democratic Party, while, you know, it can legitimately say, look, it's the party in Congress right now that's actually trying to concretely improve the lives of Americans, and especially working class Americans, there is still some kind of major either messaging divide, cultural divide, what have you, within the party that's leading to a disconnect in the minds of voters. So Rui, back in September on the Liberal Patriot newsletter, you wrote this. You wrote, this is just to pick up on your point, you wrote, another reason for Democratic complacency is the firm belief that Democrats' working class problem is solely confined to whites, and that white working class voters are so racist or reactionary that it's a badge of honor to ignore them. So I reread that. And then on Twitter, just yesterday, now Twitter being Twitter, right, little asterisks there, but I bumped into this tweet from Amy Siskind, who is a Democratic activist. She describes herself as defender of democracy, activist for women's rights, author of The Weekly List, and president of a group called The New Agenda. Okay, so she tweets here. She says, college-educated white women voted for McAuliffe by a bigger margin than Biden. Non-college white women gave it to Youngkin, and the reason was simple. Racism. They don't want progress. She goes on and says, I join others in being dismayed and disgusted by these women. I don't know how to reach non-college-educated white women. Now, that's on Twitter, right, which isn't necessarily the real world. But do you think, I mean, how much are messages like that actually, you know, filtering across the electorate? And those very same non-college educated white women, are how much are they bound to bump into that view from Democratic activists about them?
I don't think it's bound to bump in. I think they have bumped into it. I mean, that's a pretty exemplary quote from, you know, kind of a standard issue liberal wokish Democrat who, you know, sees any time when people don't vote Democratic as being exemplary of their underlying white supremacy and racism. And I think that is, puts you at a very difficult task with trying to reach persuadable voters in a very, very large demographic. Also, her claim is probably wrong. In other words, I know exactly what she's basing that on. It's from the exit polls, which are highly suspect in general, and particularly this year. In fact, what a more reliable data source says, the AP NORC VoteCast survey, is there was, in fact, significant movement against the Democrats among college-educated white women, as well as college-educated white men. In fact, the precinct-level data indicate that there were bigger swings against McAuliffe among college-educated white precincts than white working-class precincts. So that's what her claim is, simply an artifact of the data she's looking at. But her sort of histrionic claim about what it all means is I think, very much exemplifies some of the things we're talking about. And it couldn't be more politically toxic. I mean, I don't think it should be very controversial to observe that if you think this vast swath of the population are all a bunch of stone-cold racists who can't be talked to in any way and whose concerns don't have any real concerns other than wanting to hate black people, I think that, you know, this is a very, puts you in a very politically difficult position with a very, very large demographic. So, yeah, again, I think it's not that people are going to hear these things. It's that they are hearing them over and over and over from Democratic activists. And that's an extremely bad look for the Democrats.
Jack, jump in here. What do you think?
It couldn't be more toxic. You know, it's the scarlet letter, really. You're a moral pariah, and people feel that. And Republicans have been running on that neuralgia against people being called racist. Unhappily, Democratic activists take that up in their sort of virtue signaling and also in their mobilizing, right? This is a way of mobilizing, or they think it's a way of mobilizing African-American voters. Although I think there is such a disconnect there between the activist and the rank and file African-American voter. And what I'm struck with is, yes, this is a Democratic Party activist. And yes, there are these people on, as Rui puts it in capital letters, the left. But Joe Biden, you know, Joe Biden, you know, Jim Clyburn, Steny Hoyer, Nancy Pelosi, are these people, they don't quite answer to the idea of the left. They're standard issue reform Democrats with strong ties, yes, to the African-American community, but to rank-and-file voters, African-American voters who just want a better shot at life and more economic opportunity. So I'm a little leery of using abstractions like the left and having that color the actual party. You know, I mean, as people, someone pointed out the other day, far from defunding the police, the Democrats in their stimulus bill that they passed and now in prospective bill they want to pass are sending millions to hire more police. And yet the activist picture is defund the police. And I do think there's a Fox News magnification effect there, so that the activist, the Twitterverse becomes the whole, the party.
Yeah. Mm. So Rui, when you refer to the left now, who specifically are you talking about?
Well, I think when we talk about the left of the party, I mean, obviously the party as a whole is on the left of the political spectrum. That's for sure. But within the active left, within the party, a lot of the activists, a lot of the heads of advocacy groups, a lot of the people who are on Twitter, a lot of the people who run foundations, and, you know, to be honest, people in the media, they have a set of cultural attitudes you might broadly describe as woke, even though I guess a lot of people hate the term these days, but what else are we supposed to call it? They have a set of cultural attitudes that they think are the right attitudes to have on race, gender, trans issues, and so on. And they do tend to look down their schnoz at people who don't have their views and think that, you know, if people don't subscribe to them, it must mean they're reactionary and probably racist. And that's what I mean by, certainly there are people on the left of the Democratic Party, like in unions and other places, who are primarily or more concerned with economic issues and have a standard issue liberal attitude, old school liberal attitude toward issues of race and gender, which is tolerance, anti-discrimination. Everybody should get a leg up, but aren't necessarily subscribed to a radical equity leveling agenda along the lines of Ibram X. Kendi. But, you know, I think the high profile of the left in the Democratic Party today is associated with that kind of point of view and that kind of world outlook. I mean, look at people like AOC, the most famous avatar of the left today. And she's down the line with all the various things that I think most the median voter finds quite unattractive about the Democrats. Mm. So, you know, I don't want to. Yeah, I think the Democrats are still a good bet overall for, you know, sort of doing stuff that's a benefit to working class people. But that's not how a lot of working class people see it. And that's partly because of the way the Democratic Party presents itself today and who some of its most famous spokespeople on the left are. And I think the Democrats haven't really faced up to the necessity of dissociating themselves from those kinds of points of view, rather than sort of, Joe Biden said, I don't believe in defunding the police. The problem was that was branded on the Democratic Party by the way the Democratic Party handled the Black Lives Matter movement and by the refusal of a lot of politicians to take a stand against it. And it's really hurt them. And it's going to hurt them in 2022 as well, I think.
Yeah. So we've just got a minute to go before the break. And I want to ask you to talk a little bit more about essentially what Jack is bringing up very strongly and correctly here, I think, because on the one hand, yes, I mean, it's about what, 69 or 70% of the total U.S. Electorate in terms of the number of registered voters, that's still white in this country. It's still almost 70%. And then within that, there is still a large white working class here. And again, we just got 30 seconds before the break, so I'll let you finish when we come back. But you've written extensively, Rui, on this, that you say that Democrats have to face up to the fact that you think they have a class problem. An education divide and a class problem.
Yes.
Okay. Well,
do you want me to start? Or you said, well, I just have 30 seconds.
No, you've done me a favor here because now I don't have to actually cut you off. So,
right.
I'm going to leave listeners hanging. We're going to come back in 90 seconds and talk about
class and education with
Rui Teixeira and cool. Jack Beatty, because Rui Teixeira has been following the Democratic Party closely for many decades now. And we're also going to hear from him about what he thinks is in the party's future. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Jack Beatty and Rui Teixeira. And Rui, before the break, I was going to ask you, or did ask you, about what you call a kind of education polarization gripping the Democratic Party. So talk more about that and why you think they're too relaxed about it.
Right. The education polarization trend is extremely strong, and it's just gotten stronger over time, particularly in 2020, even though the Democrats did win. And the polarization is very simple, is that at this point, the Democrats do far better among college educated voters controlling for demographic than they do with working class or non-college voters. And again, we saw this very strongly in the 2020 election. We actually see this in Virginia results as well. Now, famously, the Democrats have lost support among white working class voters, even as they gained support among white college educated voters. So there's polarization there for sure. We've seen that for a long time. It really emerged in spades in 2016. However, what's very important is that we're now really starting to see it among non-whites, particularly Hispanics, but also black voters as well, where working class voters are moving away from the Democrats at a rate that considerably eclipses that of college-educated non-whites. Since 2012, according to the best data we have available, the Democrats have lost 18 margin points off of their support among non-white working-class voters. That's a lot, and that sort of underscores the extent to which Democrats may have been complacent about their ability to continue to benefit from the rise of non-whites as a share of the voting electorate. Your share can go up, but if significant parts of that group start moving away from you, that cancels out the effect of the larger share. And that's particularly been true with Hispanics, where we've seen this, you know, very, very significant move of working class Hispanics away from the Democratic Party. I mean, and about 80% of Hispanics can be described as working class. They're a relatively low education population. So this is a very serious problem. The Democrats, as I observed in another piece I wrote for the Liberal Patriot, there just aren't enough college educated voters. This remains a working class country in that sense. And again, particularly among non-white constituencies. So if you're very reliant on the college educated vote, you're relying on, you know, 30-35% of the voting electorate. And perhaps less in some places. So, I mean, this is really quite remarkable that Democrats have gotten themselves into this pickle as, you know, the party that traditionally was the party of the working class. In fact, if you look at the working class as a whole, the multiracial working class, the trend has definitely been toward the Republicans being more the party of the multiracial working class than the Democrats. And we saw that in 2020, where the Republicans, Trump actually had a slight edge among overall working class voters.
Yeah,
according to the best data. So this is quite a development, and I think is underrated by most observers.
Okay, so the forever question that's been asked 100 times or 1,000 times before, it'll be asked 1,000 times again, is the why, though. I mean, you very convincingly laid out the trend. But the why? I mean, is it really these ongoing culture wars? Or what? I mean, what has your analysis shown?
Well, I think that there are basically two factors. One was laid out very well by Jack Beatty earlier in terms of talking about what's happened in a lot of the areas of the country where working class people, particularly white working class people, are concentrated. They're in communities that have basically fallen behind the overall evolution of the country economically. They do feel left behind. They feel like elites don't care about them. Their economic progress and their communities relative to more prosperous areas have not only fallen behind in many cases, but significantly declined. And they feel like Democrats have not done enough for them, don't care enough about them, etc. And then you overlay on that what you refer to as the culture wars, which is the Democratic Party has increasingly become associated with a set of cultural beliefs on race, gender, and other things that these people find quite alienating and, you know, sort of feel like there's sort of a litmus test for being a Democrat now, which is you have to subscribe to a lot of this stuff around United, you know, the country is a white supremacist society. Everybody's a racist who's a white person, whether they are willing to admit it or not. You know, equity is more important than equal opportunity. We must level all the differences. Meritocracy is not the way to go. We must redistribute resources so that everybody is equal, even if regardless of the work effort or anything like that. I mean, there's a whole litany of issues around that that reflect the worldview of the college-educated liberals who dominate the Democratic Party and I would argue the commanding heights of cultural production in this country, who they associate with these elites. So it's a combination of the effects of economic change overlaid with these cultural shifts within the Democratic Party that alienate them from the median working class voter.
Well, Democratic strategist James Carville told PBS NewsHour that basically along these lines, he sums it up with one phrase. This is Carville calling it stupid wokeness.
All right. Don't just look at Virginia and New Jersey. Look at Long Island. Look at Buffalo. Look at Minneapolis. Even look at Seattle, Washington. I mean, just defund the police, lunacy to take Abraham Lincoln's name off of schools. I mean, that people see that. And it's just really have a suppressive effect all across the country. The Democrats, some of these people need to go to a woke detox center or something. I mean, that they're expressing the language that people just don't use. And there's a backlash and a frustration at that.
Jack Beatty. Yes. So Carville's expressing frustration in the direction in terms of the messaging of his party. But I would say that progressives could look at James Carville and say, well, here's a creature that brought us 90s triangulation that caused the very economic disenfranchisement that you're talking about. So why should we listen to James Carville, you know, ranting and shaking his angry fist at wokeism?
Yes, the Raging Cajun, as it used to be called. Yeah. And you know, his point about wokeism, gosh, we're going to hear that word a lot. And you know, I Googled how many members of Congress have spoken about, you know, defunding the police, just to take that element. I could only find about six. Basically, the squad, the six that voted against the infrastructure bill. Well, it's not a big part of the party. And meanwhile, on the ground, a recent poll from Detroit, by 9-1, Detroiters, it's an overwhelmingly African-American city, want more police, 9-1. So, you know, when Cori Bush comes out and says, oh, I want to defund the police, she's representing a city, St. Louis, that has one of the highest homicide rates in the country. She shouldn't be listened to on that subject. And the Democrats, I agree with Rory, have got to find a way to respectfully, cabin such people or isolate them or at least set them off. I mean, Bill Clinton did it through, remember in the campaign, he denounced Sister Souljah, the rapper, for her anti-police lyrics. Something, they've got to find a way to deal with these ultra-woke members of their party that make clear to the rest of the country that that isn't what Democrats are all about.
Yeah. You know, I would even take the analysis further and say that somehow, you know, from my minor commanding height of this host chair on public radio, but I feel like the Democrats are hapless when it comes to messaging what they're actually effective at, right? I mean, or the fact that right now, again, I could return to the big bills that the Democrats are trying to push through Congress that can have concrete, real-world impacts on the lives of Americans, and yet they're losing that messaging battle, too. So on that front, we talked to someone about this and asked her, what should Democrats do about messaging in 2020 and beyond?
For too long, Democratic consultants have given politicians a choice. Talk about race as if your only audience is Black and brown people, or ignore race and just talk about the economy. Neither of those works.
So that's Heather McGee. She's a political strategist and author of The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together.
We can't be silent on the biggest tool that the right wing uses to divide working people from one another and from collective action. That biggest tool is racial scapegoating. We have to make clear that it's not about us versus them, Black and brown folks versus white folks. It's about us versus them, the 99% versus the self-interested 1% that wants to use racism as a way to divide us.
So in her research, McGee has come up with several different ways to describe messaging. Messages that focus exclusively on race, she calls those the race narratives. Similarly, those that focus on the economy alone, the class narrative. And her research reveals that voters do not tend to respond positively to either of those narratives when used exclusively. But what works is what McGee calls the race class narrative, a unifying message that helps people, quote, envision a multiracial country in which everyone has economic opportunity. So what does that messaging look like in action? Well, McGee gave us an example on a potent issue. She says this is how Democrats in Virginia should have messaged around the controversy over critical race theory.
No matter what we look like or what neighborhood we're from, we as parents all want our kids to have the best education possible. And that includes learning from students who reflect the diversity of our great nation and learning about the full history of our nation, the best of times and the worst of times. But some politicians, in order to score cheap points, are creating phony controversies and using that to ban books in schools, books that share the full experience of American history. It's not about Black history versus American history. It's all of our histories. And when young people are robbed of our common history, we're more likely to be manipulated by the same forces that want to keep us divided.
Similarly, here's how she recommended, or an example of why she recommended Democrats need to talk differently about crime.
Here in New York, where I am, we had a swing election towards the Republicans in Nassau County, which is the safest county in America. And crime was a big message on the right.
McGee says that Republicans campaigned exhaustively on law and order. They're capitalizing on, as we've discussed here, defund the police rhetoric from some Democrats. But she points out Democrats came into Washington and actually increased police budgets in 2021. So she provided an example of how she thinks Democrats should counter with what, again, she calls the race class narrative.
The people who've been entrusted to serve and protect our communities are too often targeting, detaining, and even killing our brothers and sisters. All the while, a handful of politicians are throwing out lies to divide us. They know that if we're made to fear each other, we'll look the other way while police officers who are meant to uphold the law use their badge as a license to harm our communities. And that politicians meant to govern in our name are handing millions to corporations to militarize local law enforcement and deny resources to schools and the healthcare that we actually need.
And McGee says that message was field tested.
So the core elements of that message, which is a counter to the attacks about defunding police, has these elements. It reminds us of our common values. But most importantly, politicians are using racial scapegoating to divide us, that ultimately the impact of these kinds of racist policies and politics is to hurt all of us. All of our schools are defunded when the police get 6 out of 10 budget dollars in a city or a county. That is something that is a unifying message if we reframe to understand the way that racism has a cost for everyone.
That's Heather McGee, author of The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. Now, Rui Teixeira, I know you're familiar with Heather McGee's work here. Do you think that the Democratic Party, and particularly, again, the party leaders, the elite that we've been talking about, can and is willing to embrace that kind of combined race-class narrative?
Well, I don't really think they should, because I basically disagree with McGee's whole take on it, and I think the research upon which it's based is highly suspect. Other research tends to show, and this is something of long standing, that if you frame a universalistic program in terms of effect, in terms of racial inequity or whatever, it actually tends to reduce support for universalistic programs, which, as we know, will disproportionately benefit Black and Latino poor people. So I reject the whole premise that you have to have this so-called race-class narrative. I think the evidence upon which it's based is highly suspect. That that's a technical thing I won't get into.
You reject the premise, like the premise that McGee says that Democrats can come up with a framing or a narrative that actually emphasizes unity and not division.
Well, you emphasize unity, but you don't have to specifically do it in the sense that she's talking about it. Or if you are doing it in the way she's talking about it, it's actually pretty standard issue stuff that anybody would do. Like, for example, Glenn Youngkin. In Virginia, I mean, she talked about the approach she thought should be taken to the education issue. Here's what Youngkin said. We all know education starts with curriculum. We will teach all history, the good and the bad. America has fabulous chapters, and it's the greatest country in the world. But we also have some abhorrent chapters in our history. We must teach them. We can't know where we're going if we don't know where we come from. Let me be clear, what we don't do is teach our children to view everything through the lens of race, where we divide them into buckets. One group's an oppressor and another group is a victim. We know in our hearts that's wrong. We must live up to these immortal words of Martin Luther King, who implored us to be better than what we are, to judge one another based on the content of our character, not the color of our skin.
So it works.
So that's exactly...
it works. It's just uttered by the Republican, not
right.
The Democrat.
If you're going to, but you know, that problem is the Democrats didn't echo that. They didn't say, yes, by God, you're right, Glenn. But we shouldn't ban books. But you're absolutely right about that. That is the way we should teach things. They didn't do that. They said to talk in the way that Youngkin was, and what Youngkin was all about was a racist dog whistle. So, you know, we have to realize that it's not that complicated if you concentrate on the things that you, as McGee says, unifies people, but you don't have to put it in this frame. It's like race is dividing us all. If you're going to talk about crime, I don't see how you're going to convince people unless you convince people that you're actually, as Tony Blair put it, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. You can't deal with a law and order issue by simply saying it's inequitable how policing goes down and that hurts us all.
Yeah.
That is not going to work.
Well,
I think there's obvious ways in which her, a parent, her advice is either A, sort of obvious, or B, useless and counterproductive.
You know, Rui, now we're getting started. It's the end of the hour. Dang it. We're going to have to pick this up again. Rui Teixeira, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thank you so much for joining us. And Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst. It was great to have you as always, Jack. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.